WFM with Green Farm. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Farm's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
It's Thursday the 19th of November and you're very welcome to Game On. I'm afraid I can't hear Ruby, so I'm going to have to keep on talking. Coming up tonight, John Hayes tells us how to knock lumps out of England.
Stringer looks to take control of it, moves it towards O'Gara. O'Gara with a cross field kick, tries to get Shane Horgan. Gathers the ball! Horgan touches it down! Throws the ball up in the air! The old Gaelic football has come in handy. He rose, he caught, he conquered, he scored.
Journalist Mick Foley explores Croke Park's bloody history 100 years on from that shocking day back in 1920.
I think most people waking up in the morning on the 31st of November 1920 in Dublin are aware of this sort of conflict. Perhaps they're even exercised by it, they might have an opinion on it, but it's probably quite peripheral to their lives.
Lauren McGee chats ahead of the upcoming ladies' football semi-finals.
Carly Robeson, thrust of her shoe, try and chance again, McCaffrey!
And if you're looking for some racing tips, stay with us because Ruby's back and I'm going to ask him to preview all the weekend's action.
And we go stateside with Shep if I'm here. Are we? Am I there, Marie?
You're back.
I'm back. Imagine I'm sitting here for the last 5 minutes looking at you going through the whole script. The only few lines I had that I definitely wasn't going to get wrong and I couldn't even read them. But we're going to go stateside with Shep as the coronavirus wreaks havoc on sport and society in general.
Two out.
Now you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM if you want to get in touch.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, Ruby, you were gone away there and I was wondering, did you go away to put on that Christmas jumper that you're wearing? And I just have to say that I didn't think you'd be the Christmas jumper type.
You're right, Marie, I'm not. I came from Racing TV today, so I had to try it on when Isabel took a picture that I could send back to them when I didn't have time to take it off. But actually, I did have time now that I think about it, because I didn't realise you weren't going to be able to hear me, so I could have actually taken it off and put back on my other one. But look, I'm dressed up and made an effort today, and you're in your usual gym gear.
Well, that's true. I do like the old gym gear, but let's not get into that conversation, because we could end up in a row, I'd say.
Yeah, it was just radio suits you, doesn't it?
It actually does. Yeah, that's a very true clip. Right, well, there is a lot going on. Pep Guardiola has ended speculation over his future by signing a new 2-year contract at Manchester City. So he is extending what is already his longest spell in charge of a single club. As he neared the final 7 months of his existing contract, Guardiola used the international window to mull over his future and commit to staying at the Etihad Stadium until the summer of 2023, a time frame that would take him to 7 years in Manchester. Let's hear from him.
And at the end, we decide the best for all of us is continue, because still we have the feeling that still is not unfinished business, and still we have something to do, continue what we have done the last year. So this club won in the recent past, but being all together, we won a lot, and we won a lot, and we won again. And the target is in this club, like in the past, is not a club won a lot of titles, is continue to try to maintain in this structure of the club as long as much as possible. And that's why I still have the desire to help with all fantastic players that we have for the next years, especially our fans, but the whole football proud the way we play and the way we win.
Do you get the feeling, Marie, that if he'd had success in Europe, he would be after moving on to a new challenge, but the fact that he hasn't, that he's stuck around?
Yeah, and like it is a very funny time, and I'd say that, like, with the few managers floating around as well, I'd say he's probably keen enough to tie down a job for a couple of years, see what happens over the next little while, just in terms of the fallout for Corona. But definitely Europe, I mean, I think for the last number of years that has been on his mind. It's the one blip on his copybook, and I think he does have the players, so maybe he'll get there.
I'd say he will. I think I'm Stefan Jurgen Klopp. I think they're geniuses. They're great to have in the Premier League. I won't call it Premiership as I usually do. I will call it the Premier League for a change. And great to have them around because they are entertainers.
Yep, they sure are. I saw the story today and I thought of you, Ruby. Tiger Woods will compete in the 2020 PNC Championship alongside his 11-year-old son, Charlie. So he's going to be playing for the very, very first time with his son now. His son is a very talented junior golfer. I haven't ever seen him play or seen much of him, but I imagine that once he's on the course with Tiger Woods, that there'll be a huge amount of focus on him. Padraig Harrington is also playing in this with his son, Paddy, but I just always find it interesting when kids start to follow in their parents' footsteps. We're actually going to have Lauren McGee on in a while. She's the daughter of Johnny McGee. She's going for a fourth All-Ireland, and he's a former Dublin footballer. And of course, there's Andy Farrell and Owen Farrell. We're going to hear from Owen Farrell in a little while as well. It's just interesting when kids follow what their parents did. Is that something that you think your kids would do?
They have ponies and they ride, and if any one of the four girls decided they would like to be a jockey, I most certainly wouldn't stop them. Would I be encouraging them? I don't know. I think you have to let children find their own feet and then support them in whatever they want to do. But they ride most days after school and they enjoy it. So as long as they enjoy it, we'll keep going. Even got a headbutt from one of them today with a helmet straight into the eyes. So,
are any of them like you? In terms of the competitive nature, can you see it like?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. And they have definitely have a temper like me.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you manage that then? Is this the first time you've been lost for words?
It is. I mean, I could probably put words on them. I'm not sure if you can use them on national radio. So how do you control that? With great difficulty.
Are you looking at them going, I can't really go too mad now because I used to be exactly like that.
I wish.
Well, we're going to talk rugby very, very shortly, but the England team was named today. George Ford is going to start on the bench. He returns from injury. That's against Ireland, obviously, on Saturday with Owen Farrell, keeping the number 10 shirt. And Owen Farrell was actually speaking to the BBC today, and we have a clip of what he had to say.
They've all been different occasions. That's exactly what we'll be looking to do. This weekend is play what's in front of us and play what's needed, and hopefully make good decisions out there. So it's not a case of looking back too much at what's happened. It's a case of putting ourselves in the best place to perform on Saturday.
Do you think it's a different Ireland team now under Andy compared to Joe Schmidt?
There's differences all over the place in personnel, everything. So as I said, it's not about looking back. It's about looking forward to playing in this massive game the weekend.
You mentioned the changes in personnel. One at number 10, no Johnny Sexton. Very rare to have an Ireland team without Sexton at fly half. How will they be a different side with Ross Byrne in there at 10?
Johnny's a fantastic player, as everybody knows, and a real big leader for them. So it's an opportunity for someone else. It's an opportunity for someone else to come in and play well, and I'm sure that's what Ross will be looking to do.
And in terms of scrum half, Conor Murray on the bench for them and Gibson Park starts at 9. Is that a nod that maybe they will try and play at a bit more tempo? Because we saw against Wales when they got their speed of ball up, they were a handful.
Maybe not. everyone will have a plan, but we'll be looking forward to seeing what actually happens out there on the field. You know, Gibson Park's obviously got a couple of caps under his belt, but he's an exciting player for him. We all know what Conor can do, so we've got to look at how we can put pressure on him.
Eddie Jones decided to pick up on something that Andy Farrell had said, really, when Andy Farrell said Ireland were dominant against the Welsh, and Eddie Jones decided to say, as their coaching staff said, they were dominant. So the challenge is, can they bring a dominant Irish performance to Twickenham? Well, I don't know, so we decided to get somebody who might know, and we have managed to get the man with 105 caps for Ireland, John Hayes. John, can Ireland bring a dominant display to Twickenham this weekend?
I think they can, yeah. It's going to be hard. The last couple of games that they've played against them fellas have been tough days out, so at some stage you'll just be hoping that there's going to be a backlash and a reaction to it, and hopefully this will be the no better day to have it.
John, you had a terrific record against England yourself. You played 10 times, you won 7, only managed to lose 3 times. What did you bring to the Irish team that had a success rate like that?
It wasn't just me, anyway. Things happen like between squads, I suppose, and a lot of great players on the field at the same time, I think, would have been a lot of it. It's a huge game, like, you know, Ireland, England, so... So the boys done really well, like, up until 2018. Like, you know, they people forget they won a Grand Slam over there, playing really well on the day, and like one of just, as you'd say, self pulling up, like. But England came over and maybe figured out how to beat Ireland in 2019. They beat us in Dublin, and then they did it again before the World Cup and again. So they just seem to have got something on us now. But a lot of those players have tasted victory over England. So it's just a matter of getting it right and going back and doing it again.
There's a huge amount of focus now, John, on physicality and the power game, and you're looking for parity in the scrum and how Ireland are going to match up. Is there any way to counter that physicality that England have?
Well, you can decide not to play into their hands if you think you're playing against a team that are more physically imposing than you and want to play that way. Then you can probably try to play away from it, which has always been said about rugby: run the big pack around the place. But you, at some stage, they're going to get the ball and they're going to decide what they want to do with you. So if they decide to take you on, then you have to just face up to it and take them on and meet them head on with that aggression and physicality that they're trying to put on you. You have to put it straight back onto them early in the game before they get any confidence from it.
John, so much is made in rugby of the set piece, the line out, the scrum, etc. But when Keane Healy, Ronan Keller and Andrew Porter scrum down for the first time, looking at Marco Vinopolo, Jamie George and Kyle Snineker, what can they do? How do they go about getting the upper hand in the scrum? First one is so important.
Oh, it absolutely is. Like, you know, and it starts from now, all week, from now until the game, because you can't just get that going. You know, after we saw what England did with Georgia last week was a dress rehearsal that they had for this weekend, where they're trying to do it, and we've heard about when Georgia and England had boxing matches and everything in a scrummaging session that they had in training last year. So they've been trying to go to that level of aggression and physicality at the scrum and the importance that they put on it. And always, you know, it's coming from, it's like playing South Africa. They're not going to, don't be surprised by physicality when it comes at you. So it's from now until then they have to get their mindset right, what it's going to be like. And it's not just the front row, it's the oldest thing in scrummaging as well. It's not just about the boys in the front row, it's the whole scrum buying into what's going to be a tough day, and they just have to really get behind those boys in front and put them into it.
So is that a timing thing? So when you go down the first time, does the back row have to lock into the second row and drive the front row into the opposition?
I don't know, yeah, you have to get on, like, you have to feel the weight. You can't have any gap between the rows, between front row, second row, back row. You just watch them now as they set up the process of the scrum. Some people are obviously maybe feeling that it takes too long now to set up a scrum, but that's the way they do it now. And, you know, the front row are going to get set seconds in, the back row on, and once they come up on the call of pause, you need to feel the weight of that full eight is going to be going through. So when it's only a small little gap that they engage, but when it does, you know on the instant that you hit, as small and all as the gap is now, you will still feel who has the upper hand here, and the boys need to feel that and not give England any kind of confidence from feeling that they have the upper hand, that they gained an advantage on the hit, and then that they'll try and go for a second drive. So it has to be all 18 and after the all the weight after the chase.
So how would you analyse Ireland's scrum at the moment then?
It's been good. Like, you know, we've seen it against France. It was very good in the first hour. Obviously then there was changes made. I suppose towards the end of the game against France, there was a couple of scrums where it weren't ideal. But against Wales last week, they had the Welsh scrum under good pressure. And, you know, that's the confidence that the guys are getting from working together now. They're in camp so much that the amount of detail and time that they'll have put into that scrum, it's not just something that happens in 20 minutes. They'll be doing it on the pitch and off the field, going through videos that they have of all the games, trying to find any little thing that they can see that'll give them a trigger for how to deal with the English scrum on Saturday, having watched them against Georgia last week.
Obviously, John, we've a new captain as well in James Ryan, but he has the likes of Keane Healy, CJ Stander and Peter Omani around him. What kind of a captain do you think he'll be?
He looks like a good one from what I've seen of him as a player. Even in that game in Twickenham in February this year, he was probably the player that really put himself about on the day. He didn't get found wanting that day. So, look, there's been a lot said about him. People have seen it since he was under 20. You know he was coming through. He's grown into the game in the last couple of years as a forward, as a pack leader. And I think he's definitely old enough. When you look at what age Paul O'Connell was and Brian O'Driscoll, these guys, they were only that age when they took over. So great players like that can definitely do it. So I think as a forward in as well in the second row, especially in the game that we're talking about this week against England, that's where you're going to want that presence and an impact from him, and I think we will see something.
What makes a good captain, John?
Somebody who leads from the front. I think there's a lot to be said about how you motivate in the week leading up to, but I think when it comes to it on the day, rugby is still going to be needed about an impact, and it's probably a big carry and a big tackle. He's still really the thing that's what I would have always seen out of those players, was when it was a tough game, someone of them will always come up with a massive tackle on an English player, whoever you're playing, or a huge carry with the ball, like Tricky would make a break, or Paulie come up with a big tackle. They make an impact, they make a statement that says, follow me, like this is the way to go for today.
A great thing to have. You look at around the pitch as well, John, there's obviously a new 9 and a new 10 in a big game like this. Jemison Gibson Park and Ross Byrne, and they're facing Ben Youngs and Owen Farrell. So there's huge matchups all across the line here for Ireland.
Oh, there is, yeah. That's the way it is now in all the games. These fellas, they wanted, like, you know, Ross Byrne played there last August, whenever it was, you know, and maybe it wasn't a great day out, but I'm sure he's relishing the opportunity to go back and, you know, give a better account of himself and the team, that maybe he wasn't just the only one on the day, but because he was out half, maybe when things go well, you get a lot of credit, and when it doesn't, maybe you get a little bit more criticism. But I think those guys are really going to look forward to an opportunity, and it's the same as the front row of the scrum. It's not just about the two of them at the halfbacks. It's the quality of ball they get from the forwards. If the forwards front up, I suppose, whatever is the word you want to use, with the English forwards, then if those backs, halfbacks, and the rest of the Ireland gets good quality ball, there's definitely players there to do damage.
Just given the selection calls that Andy Farrell has made, do you kind of get a sense of what he's trying to do and what kind of a game he's trying to play?
Yeah, look, I suppose the game he's trying to play, we'll have to wait and see. The more games you see, you will see this, different things start to emerge and how he's trying to play it differently. But I think it's the chance to play different players is really the thing. So Johnny has been injured now, so Ross Byrne is starting, but it's taken an injury maybe to see how Ireland will play without Johnny Sexton, you know. So from that point of view, that's a positive, that we get to see a new player in a position that's really important for us, that we've always had somebody there, so that's a positive, and it just this tournament allows that, so that's what's good from that point of view.
So what did you make of James Lowe debut last week? He looked pretty impressive, and he's a big man to have on the wing.
He is, yeah, we've seen him for the last couple of years since he's been here with Leinster, and Wales maybe tried to get at him a little bit at the start. There was a lot of pushing and shoving, and maybe they thought they could upset him, but he doesn't look like the character that was going to get too bothered by it, and he was well up for it. He didn't take a backward step, and as the game went on, then they just seemed to didn't bother with him because they knew they weren't getting a reaction and were on top. So he's a class act. You could see him there even for that very last scrum when he got the try. He was standing around for a while. He didn't really sneak in there by surprise, but still they couldn't stop him. So that just shows the kind of power that he has.
John, we have you on because you're an ambassador for Sport Ireland's Your Personal Best campaign, aimed at encouraging men over 45 to say no more excuses and do 30 minutes of physical activity 5 days a week. How's it going for you?
It's going fine. I'm actually doing 7 days a week myself. Once I got back into it and started doing it, I just kind of just keep at it now, because it's like everything's just easier to do it than not do it. But it was just something that's, When I got asked about it, that's why unfortunately I am in that age bracket, and it was a good thing to be involved with, to get fellas to get up and get out and do a bit of exercise.
Fortunately, I'm not in that age bracket just yet, but I did
You're
find
close, it.
I am not far off it, but when I came home from Cheltenham, we were in lockdown, and I stopped riding out. I did find it hard to motivate myself to go and go back to exercising. It's not just as easy as people think.
No, it's not. When it's something that you do as a habit always, whether it's either your job or it's just something you do as a habit, whether you're a professional sportsman or amateur, once you stop doing it, maybe you just mightn't feel the motivation because there isn't Tuesday, Thursday, match of the weekend, whatever. So it's up to yourself then to get a bit of routine and motivate yourself to get out and do it. And we can always come up with the easy excuse, which in Ireland will often be the rain or something like that, but there's always a reason that you can just get out and do it.
John, we're going to be talking to Michael Foley about Bloody Sunday very, very shortly. But I think when we think of a Bloody Sunday, what comes to mind, one of the things that comes to mind is that game that he played against England in Croke Park, the very first rugby game, or the game between Ireland and England there, and the emotion that you showed during the anthem. We actually have a clip of it here. We're going to play it.
I think of all the great places I've been in my life and receptions I got, what I wouldn't have given to have been standing on that pitch that day in that line. It must have, it did, you could see the emotion in you. But when I watched it back earlier today, Brian O'Driscoll, Marcus Horan, Dunners, Peter Stringer, Paul O'Connell, Dennis Leamy, every one of you, the emotion, every one of you, how proud it must have been to stand on that pitch with that amount of people. It must have been incredible.
It was unbelievable. The 2 weeks leading into the game were just like 2 weeks I'd never experienced in sport before, because from the year before when Lansdowne Road was closed up and we were going, it became obvious we were going to be playing there. That game was obviously coming up to the second game that we played France first, but that has kind of passed off to people don't really remember it. It was that one when they realised who was coming on the first year. That just game just took on a huge importance, like, and it took on a discussion that just everybody in the country who might not follow rugby, follow GA, whatever, that everybody that was into sports had an opinion on that, whether or not we should or should not have been there. But thankfully we were, because we were allowed to open up and play there, and we just knew the responsibility that we had, that this game was a huge occasion for Ireland, and we just to be part of it. And the national anthem and all the talk about before, would there be protests and not, whatever, but the whole thing passed off perfectly, and I've never before or since, I'd say, heard Aurán Devine that way. Like, it was just unbelievable on the day.
Those games against England, John, what's it like to play in them? Do they feel different?
They do and they don't. Like, obviously, you've so many, like, the Six Nations is such an old tournament, there's such tradition there between all the countries. Well, I suppose between Ireland and England, it is, it does bring an extra edge to it. Usually it's tough, like, and I did anyway, I think most people do, they do get wound up for it, like, and you realise the opportunity you have to play, because you don't get to play them too many times, so that's kind of the way you have to look at it, try and make the most of every opportunity.
So, John, before we let you go, I never asked you to call the weekend's game.
Yeah, it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be close. I don't think we're going to see a result. I hope not. We won't see a result with the scorelines we've seen the last couple of times we've played them. I think we're going to be close. We're going to be in it. And if we can just, we have the fitness, and if we can just get the belief in those early first 20 minutes of us, I think we can stay close to them. And if we are, hopefully maybe we might get a win.
Thanks so much, John. Appreciate you taking the call. And I'd say listening to yourself and Ruby there about exercising when you're pushing on a little bit will inspire quite a lot of people. Ruby's giving me the daggers now.
Thanks, John.
I know, hopefully, yeah. If people do get up and get out now for a few weeks again, like, and even if they get the habit of it now in November, then maybe it might continue until Christmas, like, you know, and just keep on it.
Thanks, John. Thanks so much. Now, I did mention Bloody Sunday there, and the 21st of November marks 100 years since 14 victims were killed at Croke Park by Crown Forces. Our next guest is Sunday Times sports writer Michael Foley, author of The Bloodied Field, all about Croke Park on that day. And he also produced a podcast and a documentary to mark the centenary. Michael, how are you?
Good, Marie. How are you doing?
Well, you have written the book, you have done the documentary, you have done the podcast. It is obviously something that means quite a lot to you.
Yeah, I suppose, look, I started onto this about 9 years ago now, 2011. It was interesting to hear John there, obviously talking about 2007 and the game. I was at that game myself as well, and that was kind of where the interest began. There was a lot of coverage around that particular game of Bloody Sunday and Michael Hogan and all the rest of it. And it just struck me at that time that a lot of the stories around Bloody Sunday were a bit contradictory, and we didn't know how many people even had been killed, even though this was something that we all grew up thinking we knew everything about or everything we need to know about. But over the course of time, just getting lost in the subject, I suppose, it kind of was revealed to me very quickly that the power of this story and the power of the stories of the individuals who died in Croke Park that day, stories that were lost for a long, long time, but there was the huge emotional power, as I say, and also a huge amount of learning in them around what happened on Bloody Sunday and what it could tell us about that day now.
My 11-year-old daughter has come home from school this week and told me all about it and everything that happened about it. It's obviously quite topical in schools as well. Tell me about Jane Boyle and about Michael Hogan and David Carroll or Daniel Carroll and James Burke. It's a compelling story, but it's unbelievable to think that it happened in a football stadium.
Absolutely, and like that, I'll tell you, Ruby, that's one of the best things about this week is getting these stories from schools, that they're showing the documentary or they're listening to a bit of the podcast or whatever, and they're engaging with a story in history in this way. And even you just mentioning all the names there like that, it's just fantastic. But as you say, it's 100 years later, and that's the thing I think about Bloody Sunday. It's, we've all gone to Croke Park, obviously for matches, but even for people who aren't interested in sport, who maybe have gone to Croke Park to see a gig or have been at an event or something like that there, we always go there looking forward to being there, you know? And it was the same for those people in 1920. They went to that game, you know, with the same excitement and expectation as we would know going to a match. And I think that shared sense of what Croke Park means to us makes it even more incredible and unimaginable what actually occurred there in the space of 90 seconds of shooting, 14 people left dead on the field, on the banks around the ground and on the streets outside.
When you think of Jerome O'Leary climbing up a tree at 10 years of age to watch the match, it doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was William Robinson who was climbing up the tree, he was 11 years of age, yeah, but I mean, Jerome was only just down a little bit. Like, William was in the tree and he was probably the first person shot when the firing started. The police arrived on the canal bridge outside Croke Park and started firing into the ground, and William was hit in the tree. But you mentioned Jerome. I mean, Jerome was 10 years of age, and you know, I always think, you know, I was 10 when I went to my first match in Croke Park. I went to see Cork and Galway playing an All-Ireland football semi-final, and I was 10 years of age, and I can still remember the absolute excitement of the notion of going to Croke Park to see that game. Finally, this place you see on TV and maybe in pictures and newspapers. At that time, like when I was a kid, there weren't many matches on TV. So, I mean, the same excitement I would have felt. I often thought Jerome, you know, was one of the first victims that I saw as well in terms of a picture. I was in the newspaper library in London and Jerome popped up on a piece of microfilm, a picture on a page of the Daily Mirror. And I often, over the years, thought, you know, this is the link I was able to make, that he would have felt the same excitement that I would have felt as a kid going to a match, and the same excitement that we all would have felt. I mean, these people are 100 years away from us, but the emotions and the feelings that they would have had, we are linked directly to them now as a result of those.
And just finding all that information, Michael, was that a difficult job to do, just given your starting point that people weren't even sure how many victims there were?
Well, like it's like a lot of things in that kind of research. You know, you go down 10 alleys and 9 of them will be blind. But, you know, at the time, I did feel that there was a lot of information out there, but it was just scattered, and it was scattered across inquiry reports and autopsies, in newspaper reports, in the recollections of family members. Of course, finding the families was a job in itself back in 2011. The book came out originally in 2014. In the 5 or 6 years since the book came out, I've been able to get in touch with a lot more of the relatives' families, and it's been fantastic, and which allowed me to update the book this year again. But yeah, I mean, look, you're it's a lot of needle in the haystack stuff, but once you start piecing the picture together, it's been fantastic. And particularly, as I say, in the last 5 or 6 years, once the book came out, people started coming forward with different things, and there's a constant flow of information. I mean, literally, I would say maybe 3 weeks or a month ago, Keith Walsh, who directed the documentary that was on RT the other night, texted me a picture he had found of John William Scott, the 14-year-old boy who was killed. He found it in a newspaper from the time. I mean, it was the first time I'd seen him, and that was only a month ago. So, I mean, there's, you know, history is an evolving thing, and I'm sure there's more information out there about Bloody Sunday and about everything that went on. It's it's just, you know, accessing it and the ease of access is the thing. But it's, you know, it's been fascinating going through it all.
I saw a lot of the relatives in the documentary that you made. How are they all feeling now?
It's an interesting question. I think, look, I can't speak on behalf of them in that regard, but what I do know is that, you know, look, for years, a lot of those families would have felt that their relative had been forgotten. And there's various reasons for that. From the GA's point of view, in terms of just kind of moving forward, and oftentimes families might have contacted the GA and other places as well looking to tell their story, and it just kind of fell through the cracks. So that would have left them often feeling, you know, frustrated, maybe alienated, isolated. But as I say, in the last 5 years, I mean, when I finished the research in 2014, we realised that there was eight of the 14 victims were in unmarked graves. And that prompted kind of an interest from my end in what can we do here. And while I was thinking that, the Boyle family, Jane Boyle's family, mainly through the work of her grandnephew, Richard Boyle Staveley, had begun the process of erecting a gravestone for her in 2015. The GAA got on board with that as well, offering some assistance. And from that grew the Bloody Sunday Graves Project, where the GAA have offered assistance if the families want to erect a gravestone to their loved one. And that has opened up that process. I think when the dust has settled on all of this, that project and the erecting of the gravestones will be the most significant thing that happened, because it allowed the families a way back into the story, if you like. It allowed the victim a way back into the story, and it also allowed the GAA to engage with the Bloody Sunday story in a different way, to reconnect with these families. I mean, you'll hear John Horan, the GAA president, and others now talk about the 14 people who came to a match and never went home. They talk about a duty of care to their families and to the victims themselves. I think that's been a huge change. And it's also allowed the rest of us, knowing the stories of these victims and the families, and it's the families who deserve huge credit for looking after these stories for so many years, we can now look at Bloody Sunday through the prism and through the eyes of these people, and it gives us a completely different insight into what occurred on the day.
And just in terms of the GAA, how much of a seminal moment was that day for the GAA and their link to Croke Park?
Oh, I think it was obviously huge. I mean, the GAA in 1920 had only purchased Croke Park in 1913, so it was only 7 years old. So for Bloody Sunday, for that episode, for that massacre to happen in Croke Park, and obviously you had the significance of Michael Hogan, the Tipperary footballer, being killed on the field. It was a seminal moment in the sense that the GAA now were tied forever to Croke Park, that this would become a spiritual place almost to the GAA. Now, down the years, the telling of the Bloody Sunday story, I suppose it's a complex thing, but essentially it got distilled down to Michael Hogan, and that the other 13 victims kind of got removed from the story. And that's not the fault of the Hogan family or anybody else. It was just the way that the story evolved. And oftentimes, I suppose Bloody Sunday would have been used not by the organisation in a kind of formal way, but certainly by individuals in the GAA as a way of somehow elevating the GAA and its sense of Irishness and its place in the struggle for freedom and so on and so forth. When in reality, you know, the GAA's relationship with Bloody Sunday was far more complex than that, but certainly that was how it evolved over the years. And you know, look, we only have to look at the debate around the opening of Croke Park for those rugby games and the football games in the middle of the last decade, and how significant a role the story of Bloody Sunday played in those debates around whether Croke Park should be opened up or not, to tell us exactly how profound a moment it was to the GAA.
And Michael, you have to be commended as well, because you did an absolutely huge body of work to make a lot of this happen, to tell these stories, to find this information, to produce what you've produced in the book and in the documentary and the podcast. It's really fantastic.
Well, I appreciate it, but you know, I just always think that, number one, the families looked after these stories when none of the rest of us were listening, and they deserve, you know, the world of our gratitude for curating and cherishing the memory of those people and looking after the memory. And you know, you've people like Ian Murphy in Croke Park, who works in the press office there for the GAA, who has been an incredible driver behind this, particularly the Bloody Sunday Graves Project, and he's been really to the forefront, really, in terms of making sure that the victim stories come to the centre of it. The two pair films who made the documentary, like, you know, I think a lot of the people that have helped us along the way who've understood what we're at. You know, this is purely and entirely everything we do, the focus is on the victims and getting the victim story back front row center. And that has been our focus entirely for so long now. And it's wonderful, like Ruby said earlier there, when you can name off those names, you know, and when you know that the children in school are getting the opportunity to learn this story in a different way through these people. I mean, that just means the absolute world, I can tell you, the absolute world.
Well, the documentary is still on the player. If anyone hasn't seen it, it is well worth checking out. And the podcast can be found on the GA website, Michael?
That's right, yeah, the GA website, but you'll find it on Spotify and all the usual places you can get your podcast as well.
Brilliant. Michael Foley, thanks so much for joining us.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm's on-the-go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back, Ruby. It is a busy weekend of racing ahead.
It surely is, Marie. Obviously, on Saturday in Haydock Park, you have the Betfair Chase, where last year's winner Lost in Translation, ridden by Irish jockey Robert Power, bid to defend his crown and defeat Bristol Demoy again. Clan de Zobo also takes him on and Bells Hill, but that is the feature in Haydock on Saturday. Whilst in Ascot, Lorena will make her debut for Paul Nicholls in the Ascot Hurdle. She only has three rivals to take on, Call Me Lord and Song for Someone. It'll be interesting to see how she gets on. She ended her campaign in quite disappointing fashion here last year for Willie Mullins, so it'll be interesting to see if Paul Nicholls can revive her.
How would he do that?
I don't know. It's a good question. Change of environment, change of scenery. She had breaking blood vessels, which means she was bleeding from her nose in her last couple of runs, which is a very hard thing to cure in a racehorse. So if he has managed to fix that, he might be able to reignite some fire in her, but it's a hard thing to do, and maybe a career in the breeding shed might be on the cards for Lorena. Good race in her home as well, Marie. You have the Popular Square Chase in Naas on Saturday. Fakir Dudari, Notebook and Cashback, who were three big fancies in last year's Arkle, line up in the Popular Square Chase in Naas. And Manila Indo, who looks like a Gold Cup fancy for Henry de Bromhead, runs in Navan on Sunday. And there was a good winner today in Turles in the Boomerang Chase. Presenting Percy got back to winning ways when he beat Ken Boy and Mona Lee in a very taking performance for Gordon Elliott and Jack Kennedy.
I'm going to go back to Lorena. When a horse moves, do owners, are they annoyed? Are trainers looking, going, I hope that new trainer doesn't do better than I did?
Oh sure, that's like anything. It's no, you can't wish somebody bad luck. Lorena, Jared Sullivan or Sullivan Bloodstock moved his horses back from Ireland to the UK. There was 10 or 12 of them went from Willie Mullins's. They went back to Paul Nicholls's. Now Jared Sullivan had started with Paul Nicholls, so they had come from Paul Nicholls's to Willie Mullins's and then they went back. So bit topsy turvy, but no, you don't want to wish anybody bad luck. But I suppose the bit of a competitor in you might be hoping they wouldn't be any more successful than they were for you.
How competitive is it for the trainers?
Ultra. Ultra competitive. Sure, it's an individual sport and they're running their own businesses. So if you imagine how competitive is football, well, William Mullins is Dublin. Gordon Elliott is Kerry. That's how competitive it is. And you're trying to win as much as you can and stay at the top. Joshua Bryan, Henry de Bromhead, Noel Mead, the list goes on. It's very competitive. It's a free trade, and whatever owners you can attract and whatever horses you can get, the better horses you have, the better chance you have. Even looking at presenting Percy today, I mean, he used to be trained by Pat Kelly in Galway. His owners moved him to Gordon Elliott's yard, and now he's back on a winning trade and has put himself back in the Gold Cup picture, which is very hard for Pat Kelly to watch, but it's good for Gordon Elliott.
Right, well, it is. Actually, just before we finish up on it, what about young trainers coming through? Is there many? Like, a lot
there
of the names
loads,
you mentioned are the ones we already
it's
know.
It's hard to get going, Marie, because the bigger yards, and it's financial as well. It costs X per day to train a racehorse. And if you're a young trainer, you probably have to charge a little bit less than the big trainers. But the big trainers are keeping the margins tight, and it makes it very hard for the smaller trainers to get going.
And finally, tip for the weekend.
A tip for the weekend, I think Gallop in the Champ in Goran Park tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
Actually around lunchtime, could be 1 o'clockish.
Very good. And tomorrow's Friday. That's the weekend, pretty much, anyway. Now, we are flying through the Championship games. I actually don't think that was something I would have even thought about saying a few months ago, but it is brilliant to be flying through them. The Ladies Football Championship is at semi-final stage. Cork and Galway will face off on December 6th, while Armagh and Dublin will go head-to-head on November 28th. And I'm delighted to say that Dublin's Lauren McGee joins us on the line. Lauren, how are things?
Hey, how are you?
Thanks so much for coming on. Look, it's a strange championship, and I think that's why I was saying I didn't think that we would be even probably at that, this stage a few months ago. Well, it's been strange watching it. What's it like playing in it?
Yeah, it's a weird one, but it's good to be back. I think people are a bit kind of a bit scared going into it being like winter football, but once you got into the flow of things, it's been great to be back. And to be fair, we've gone two good days for weather-wise with our matches, and it's been mild enough out, so it hasn't been too bad, but it's been great to be back.
Have you been doing anything different, just considering the time of year that we're in?
No, we actually haven't. To be fair, like it's actually been the exact same training-wise. Obviously, it's a lot more condensed, so trying to condense the training a bit more, so... That's the only thing really that was different, to try and like make, obviously you'd obviously start in January with league and then lead up to championship, whereas obviously this year you're literally straight into a championship, so that was the only thing that was different. But it was more so that the training was condensed, but people were obviously doing their own thing while lockdown was on, and then obviously we went into club as well, so we had the whole like kind of a club championship underneath our wings as well coming in, so that was good as well.
Lauren, are you enjoying the slightly quicker turnaround in games? I know you're saying you condense the training, but you're having to play in matches quicker. Are you enjoying that aspect of it?
Yeah, I am. Like, it's I prefer to play every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, than have a big, huge break, because you get in the flow of things. So, yeah, no, I really do. I really enjoy, like, especially when it's group stages. Like last year and the year before, we've done group stages, and it's been kind of that set up anyway. But, yeah, no, I do like the quick turnaround. It's a lot better.
You were the first to book your semi-final spot, beating Donegal and Waterford. How did you find just getting to the pace of championship?
Yeah, it was a lot harder this year. Obviously, it's totally different playing challenge matches and training matches, and then going in and playing a match against like a competitive team. Like, it's totally different. So it has been a lot harder, I think, to get the gel right and to get the competitive side a bit up. But we're getting there, like, hopefully, like, with the two games under our belt now, it's just what we needed.
Lauren. Now, you're going to be playing Armagh in the semi-final. We saw them with an absolutely, I think it's fair to say, a pretty massive shock. They defeated Mayo on Saturday, and they looked very impressive, particularly Amy Mackin and Kelly Mallon. So they will no doubt put up a big challenge, Sheilauren.
Yeah, they're a great team. Obviously, the two players that you mentioned there, and a lot of other players as well. Like Caroline and stuff, they're a really good team. Like, they beat Cork last year and they beat Mayo this year, so I never doubted them going into the match, like, especially with the performance they put up against Tyrone as well. Like, the girls like scored high scores as well, so they're a great team, and we just have to be at our best, and we have to do like just knuckle down for the next 2 weeks and be prepared as much as possible going into it.
It's because of the time of year that we're in, and there's so much going on. Like, we're not really talking, we're not really saying four in a row just quite yet, because there's so many other things going on as well. But that must be nice for you guys, because it is kind of going along under the radar almost.
Yeah, no, to be honest, we always anything like the talk of three in a row, four in a row. We always just kind of we park it anyway. It's always game one, game two, game three. You never look beyond the games anyway, the game that's in sight, so we'd never be looking like we have this as game three coming up, so you never look beyond it. But it is nice that it isn't being mentioned like the way the other years, like three in a row and stuff.
Lauren, Marie was asking me earlier, she was talking about Tiger Woods playing golf with his son Charlie in a couple of weeks' time in a big golfing championship. But anyway, she was asking me about my kids riding horses. Obviously your dad Johnny played for Dublin. Did you feel pressure to play football, or inspired by him to go and play football?
Never pressured, to be fair to him. He's never pressured any of us. I've three younger sisters, and he's never pressured any of us. Like, when I was young, until I was about 8 or 9, between nursery and going and playing matches, I hadn't I didn't have any interest in. And he began a bit annoyed on the sideline, but he left me to it, and then eventually I kind of clicked with it, and he was delighted then. But no, we do bond over it, and obviously growing up having him and Darren play like with Crokes and Dublin, I always then went to all their matches, was looking up to them, so it was great to have them like to watch and to learn from as well.
That's really interesting that it took a little while for it to click, because, you know, often up at nursery, parents asking, oh, you know, my kid's not that into it, but sometimes it just comes a little bit later.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. Like, even my little sister, Ava, she tried everything, like Irish dancing, ballet, you know, like, and then she went to Camogie. She was enjoying Camogie, and then she actually was like, oh, wait, no, I do want to play Gaelic football. And it wasn't until, like, she was a good bit older that she started playing it, and now that's like her number one sport. So sometimes it does take that bit longer. Like, a lot of the girls that are on our team, like, they start playing like Carla Rowans and Issa Kane and stuff, were a lot later coming into even playing Gaelic at all, like 12, 13. So like, sometimes it just isn't there when you're younger, so that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try it out. Like, so for me, I did start young, but I didn't, like, I just went for the chats, to be honest. I should say, to be chatting to my friends, and like, as my friends know, I don't shut up anyway, so I was there for all the chats. But then eventually I got into a rhythm of it, and then obviously realised that was something that I wanted to do.
Lauren, obviously you'll be hoping this won't be until after Dublin have won another All-Ireland, but you are going to be heading to Melbourne with Sinead McGoldrick and Niamh McAvoy to play for Melbourne FC. Are you looking forward to that? You must be.
Yeah, no, definitely. It's quite the adventure. Like, even moving away from home, I've never been away from home more than 2 weeks, like, without family. So like it'd be 4 months now, which is obviously isn't that big of a thing, but it's obviously for me, like, I have a big family. I have like 6 siblings, and that's going to be a bit difficult. But no, I'm really looking forward to it. Obviously, a great challenge, a new sport, and obviously to play at a professional level. And I've never thought that I would get the chance to ever play professional sports. So I'm really grateful to get the opportunity to go out.
When you make any decision in life, you always wonder about what the people around you think, and you must have taken great backing from what Mick Bowen said by saying we should not be frightened by girls going to play in Australia. Inter-county football is here to enhance their lives, not stifle them. To get the backing from someone like that must have made the decision feel easier.
Yeah, no, like, you do have that kind of, when you're telling the likes of your manager like about it, you do have that kind of sinking feeling, like, oh, what's he going to think, and what's the girls going to think with Dublin, and you're always that bit like scared about it. But he was great from the offset, and as like he was talking about, as he said all those things, like, it just made it that bit easier, like, going to him and telling him. Like, he was obviously the first person I told out of like any of like anyone in like the in Dublin or anything. So but he was so, like, as you said, like, he's not like, it's Gaelic football is supposed to be there to try and enhance our lives and not like cry about anything. So no, he's been great. And like, as the girls and I, like, when you're with Dublin, you're Dublin, and Melbourne are great. They know that, and obviously you have to do some skills on the side, but it's our main focus is Dublin, and until Dublin's finished, it won't be Melbourne.
Lauren, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Lauren was speaking at the launch of the Beko Club Champion, a competition open for all Leinster GAA clubs, aiming to highlight the incredible work that was carried out by clubs during 2020. People are asked to nominate their club to be in with the chance of winning 1,000 euro worth of equipment. For more information, visit leinsterga.ie/Beko Club Champion.
Game on. With Green Firm. Green Firm's new on-the-go chicken bites are natural, high in protein, and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Well, welcome back to Game On. We haven't got a whole pile of time left, but seeing as the NFL have introduced some intensive COVID-19 protocols, we thought we'd get the opinion of Jeff Shepherd on them. Jeff, what exactly are the NFL going to do?
So it sounds like they're going to make players, they want players to start wearing masks even when they're at practice. You know, teams have had, you know, outbreaks. I'd say, you know, the vast majority of teams have had some sort of issue you know, in their facilities. And, you know, there's not a lot of time built in right now into the schedule. There's been discussions about even potentially, you know, maybe adding an additional playoff team just in case, you know, games have to get canceled. And it's all coinciding with, you know, as, you know, the weather's getting colder, you know, flu season's kicking off, and there's just been this big uptick, you know, in the last month or so, all across the country, you know, hot spots all over the place. And so they're trying to hopefully be proactive, at least from their standpoint, so, you know, people aren't getting sick and they don't have to cancel games.
And Shep, while all that's going on, Drew Brees is now out for several weeks with multiple broken ribs. Not good news for you.
No, not at all. But, I mean, luckily the Saints are winning. But, yeah, he took a pretty big hit in the San Francisco win on Sunday. And he's got broken ribs on both sides and a punctured lung. And, you know, he's only planning on missing 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm like, is this guy Superman? Like, who recovers from an injury like that so quickly? But, yeah, you know, he's been a, you know, an Iron Man to the Saints over the last, you know, basically 15, 16 years. Missed some time last year with a finger injury, and now he's going to miss a couple of weeks. So they're going to have Jameis Winston more than likely kind of fill in that starting role, but they'll still play some Taysom Hill. But the Saints are 7-3, tied with Green Bay for the top spot in the NFC. And they play their, you know, their rivals, the Falcons, this week. But this is a big injury. I mean, he and Tom Brady obviously go back and forth. They own just about all the passing records, one or the other one does. But it'll be interesting to see how the Saints react.
It surely will. Shep, thanks a million for the update.
Thanks, Shep.
Appreciate it, guys. Have a good show.
Talk bye to bye. You soon. That's us, Ruby.
Is it, Marie?
Yeah. You can take you're off the Christmas jumper now.
Oh. Halloween was terrible. The summer wasn't much better, so I thought I'd get the Christmas spirit early.
Getting in on it early. Well, we will be back tomorrow. We'll have soccer with Lisa Fallon, and we'll have lots of Gaelic Games previews because it is another big weekend. Tara
Stewart. Because that's what you want to do. Just
exactly.
Go GAA all the
give
way.
Give the people what they want.
Go range, available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.